And I'm going to ask you whether there is anything you can suggest as far as you understand these concepts. This is a law in court procedure, where no case is started on Friday, because one may not be able to finish it before Shabbos. That's the great tragedy. One continues it on Sunday. What does it matter if one doesn't finish it on Shabbos? One continues on Sunday. Says the Gemara, it's impossible to do. And the reason that the Gemara gives, because, to give you the exact words, Minshu Tamai, the reasoning of the case will be forgotten. From Friday to Sunday, the reasoning of the case will be forgotten. Then the Gemara goes on to say, after God is made since Prima Dayoni owned in the Chosvi, it's true that two stenographers, is that what they call them here? Mm-hmm. Two stenographers are taking down every word that is being said. Notice that's true. Nehi debepuri kasli, libe beinshi inashi. What they write down is what the mouth speaks. But libe beinshi inashi, what the heart says, that is what the heart, that's the matter of the heart that is forgotten. Those are the difficult words. Libe beinshi, the matter of the heart, that is what is forgotten. So, it is a law. No base bin sits on Friday to start the case on Friday. It will sit on Friday to conclude an ongoing case. But it will not start a case on Friday which might be concluded on Sunday. Now, I must ask you, does it make sense or doesn't it make sense? If everything is written down. But what is the reason?
Because
you
get
the
gestures
and
expressions.
But you see how strict the case is. And this is not only on a criminal charge, but this is in a civil case. This is in a civil case where the plaintiff and the defendant have put in their plea and the defense, where everything has been written down, where everything can be read and re-spoken. Nevertheless, from Friday to Sunday, that is not permitted. So therefore, no case will begin on Friday. If anybody wants to have a case, it's got to be put off to Sunday and it's only begun on Sunday. That's clear. I want to get some idea of what this is about. I'm going to quote to you another piece of the book. Rabbi Yochanan was the youngest disciple of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. He said that my Torah I received because I saw the finger of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi protruding from his cup, from his cup. This is a cup. The only thing is that in those days they used to wear longer coats and wider cups. Cups went quite longer, you see, so the man wanted to use today. So he saw his finger protruding. That is another demon. Does it make sense or doesn't it make sense? Rabbi Yochanan said, I merited my Torah, that Torah which I forget, by seeing or by watching the finger of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, that is his teacher, protruding from his cup.
did. But what we now call non-verbal language. He saw what he did at certain points. Sensitivity in the fingers.
To the extent that that is from where he got his favorite from.
Isn't it possibly a metaphor saying that I was that observant of my teacher that I noticed that this particular thing happened, and because I observed and was so attuned to Rabbi Judah Hanasi, I therefore gained this great man's wisdom, a glimpse of this great man's wisdom.
Very good, but that's not what it means. Very good, but it's true in itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's true in itself. That is, it's not quite what it means. Yeah. And the piece that he sees it, that shows that this is not quite what it means. What you say, the process in itself is correct. Yes, the extent couldn't be. You see that large extent that we see that. What do you want to say, Pat?
When you read something, you don't get the same thing out of it when you're listening to one of the teachers who has much to give you, talking to you. It's not the same as if you're reading it yourself.
It's all very good. Now, it's all speaking around the subject, and it's all part of the subject. Now, let us get into the subject itself. You heard me say that when we speak about a body and a soul, the person has got a body and a soul. Everybody's got a body and a soul. When we say a person's got a body and a soul, and it is a body and a soul, it doesn't only apply to a person, but it applies to everything in creation. Now, Hashem's creation is divided in the scientific world into three parts. In the Torah world, it's divided into five. The lowest form is mineral. Then there's vegetable. Then there's animal. Then there is what we call medabeir, human, speech, Jesus speech. And finally, there is the Torah Jew. That the Jew who is, whose whole life is imbued with Torah, is based in Torah, and it's Torah to speak with everything else. And the Torah is all embracing of everything left or of everything else, he falls into a category of his own. Whether there are such people today who fall into that category is questionable. Possible, possible not. I'm not prepared to make a statement about it. Everything has a good and an assurance. Everything has got a body and a self. It's not only the human being that's got a body in itself. The animal has also got a body in itself. The mere fact that it can move, it's got a body in itself. A plant has got a body in itself. That it grows, it can reproduce itself. The power it has that it grows is itself. And when you come to the domain, when you come to that which is mineral, that also has a body and a soul. The only thing is, instead of calling it a body and a soul, we are now going to call it matter and form. So in a mineral, we're dealing with a mineral. That is its matter. Its form is that power which holds which moves the particles of sand together, and it makes of it a rock, a piece of granite. What is a piece of granite composed of? Particles, grains of sand. And there is a power which holds these grains of sand together, and that power is its neshama. That power is its soul, or that power is its surah. So now we have, with the darkness, we've got the truth, and we've got the neshama, which really equals the chayyim, the matter, and the surah. So we are going to call it a matter and form. Chomer and Tsuro. Chomer is matter, Tsuro is form. Matter and form. And we find now that we are dealing with anything that we deal with. We deal with a rock, we've got its matter and its form. Now, until now, what I've told you until now isn't particularly Jewish. It's Torah, the Torah deals with it. But this you find all over. Aristotle deals with it. And Aristotle gives an example, and the example is an important example because it gives you an extension, but a very important extension of the idea of Chomer and Tsuror, of matter and form. But it is an extension that, as one extends it, becomes a fundamental issue in the question of matter and form. The extension is as follows. I will give you Aristotle's example, and then you will see that point. Aristotle says, Michelangelo, that is Michelangelo, of course, Michelangelo, or a very great sculptor, is getting ready to sculpt out of a piece of marble. So he gets the raw block of marble out of the forest. And he's now got it on his premises, and he has his tool and his mallet in his hands. As that piece of marble stands there, that it is a mineral, that is its matter. That it is marble is its form. Its chomer is its a mineral. Its tsuro is its form. And then he begins, and he polishes it, and he rounds it, and makes it ready that he's going to at least begin working on it. And now the marble becomes the chomer, and the tsuro is the block that he has now ready to start working on. And now he starts working on it, and as he works on it, this block of marble takes on a shape. Don't know what shape it is, but it takes on a shape. And now the block of marble becomes the chomer, and the shape it is in is the tsuro. And we are watching him sculpting. And out of this shape, we can now see the shape of a human being. So the shape becomes now the chomer, the matter, and the human being becomes the form. And we are observing this. And the human being is now a woman. Now the human being is the matter. What before was form, at this stage now becomes matter. And the woman is the form. And now he's putting his final touches to it. And now we see the complete picture. The woman is Venus, says Aristotle. And so the woman now becomes the matter, and Venus is the form. What was previously form now becomes matter. Now that is already, as I say, an extension of Homer the Tsuro, but with us it is a very important principle, as we are going to see, and that principle is called Nishmosa de Nishmosa, the Torah principle. I've given you an important example because it's just a first-class example. It's a beautiful example. Being called Mishwasar, the Mishwasar. You know there is a statistic.
Mishwasar?
The Mishwasar?
You said the first one. Wrong.
Which I am. You see that? I'm going to give you whatever you have to do now. Mishmosa de Mishmosa. That we call the soul of the Christ. And it goes on. Sorry, I should say, put it this way. Really, this is the way it goes. Yeah? Mishmosa de Mishmosa de Mishmosa de Mishmosa. You see, it's never ending. It's never ending, really. Got it?
You can just translate that.
The soul of the soul.
Oh,
the soul of the soul. This is what you know about that. It's more to be the soul of the soul. You see, it's not it's calling it now not the soul of, it's not the soul of the group, it's not the soul of the body, it's not the tsura of the chayim, it's not the form of the matter, but it's the soul of the soul, it's the form of the form. The form of the form. Yeah. Now, let us get carried to the next point of the shiur. We have said that a person has a body and a soul. An animal has a body and a soul. The soul is nothing like the human being. Human being soul, it's life. It's a biological soul. The vegetable has a soul. It's a botanical soul. The domain, the mineral has a soul. And he describes what the soul of the mineral was. Now we come to another question, and that is that even that which is abstract has got a soul. Let us speak about a thought, and let us speak about an idea. A thought and idea also have a soul. So a thought and idea has got a body, and a thought and idea has also got a soul. To give you an example, if I were to give information, a fact of information. The Earth, the Sun is 350,000 times the size of the Earth, of the globe of the Earth. You make a note of it, you write it down, and anybody can have that information. A person who has never been out of Appalachia, is there a place called Appalachia?
Yeah.
A person who's never been out of Appalachia can know that information. He can sit for an examination and A, B, C, D, what, how many times greater is the sun than the earth? Twice as great? 350,000 times as great? 1,000,000 times as great? Or 20,000,000 times as great? And he puts on the second one on B, he puts his cross. 350,000 times a day, which is 3 marks for him. He's got the information. He knows nothing about mathematics. All he can count to is for 10. At a pinch, he can count to 20, but then he can't take his shoes off. That's all he can do. But he knows he's got the information that he says the sun is 350,000 times the size of the earth. He doesn't know the size of the earth, he doesn't even know the size of Appalachia. He's got no idea of the size of the earth, he's never been out of Appalachia. He doesn't know the size of America. I didn't know the size of America until I came down. Doesn't know the size of America. Simply doesn't know the size of the globe. But that he knows, that the sun is 350,000 times the size of the earth. That is the Chomer HaChochma. That is the matter of him, of the thought that he has. He's got nothing of the Tzura. But a person who knows the Tzura, he knows what 350,000 is. He knows the size of the earth. He's got quite a different conception of what the size of the sun is as compared to the earth and as independent of the earth. Got quite a different conception. He knows something, he's got the tsura, whereas the affirmation person has only got the concept. That's very clear. Now, the example is perhaps too simple. We work with formula. Whatever we do, in mathematics we've got formula, in chemistry we've got formula, in physics we've got formula. All we do, we work with computers today, the computers have the formula and they've got the whole thing. I remember when I was once given a formula, and I asked the person who gave me the formula, how do you work it out like that? It's just not worried about how you work it out. You've got the formula, you use it, that's all. But I want to know how it works out. He said, you don't have to know how it works out. You've got the formula. I couldn't make him understand, so I said, how did the first person who got that formula, how did he come to that formula? How did he work it out? So he says that everybody who's got nothing to answer says, that is a good question. But I wasn't satisfied with that. I wanted to know what the answer is. I think you've got the formula that it is the focus of all questions. I wanted to know how many candles one really is on fire. That's a good answer. Very simple.
You want to know the sum. How many candles are you get? How many do you need? The first night, how many? One. Mm-hmm. One. The last night? Eight. So the first you call eight. So you add together the first one and the last one. And we take the number of nights and we divide it by two. So how many nights are there altogether? Eight, and we divide it by two, we've got four. Times the first of one plus eight. That equals 36. So here, I hardly need it to work out that. But I will need it for a greater number. For example, if I were to take a number, like 150. And so how many do I need if I'm going to last? One the first night, two the first night, then go to 30 on for 50 nights. That's going to be very much more difficult. But this is the same formula. And the formula is that the sum, you take the number of the series divided by two, and the first one plus the last one multiplied by half the number. That's it. I wanted to know how the first person got to the idea. And I found out. He was a schoolmaster. And the schoolmaster of a very ordinary high school. And in the lower grades of the high school. And this schoolmaster had a lady friend. And he wanted to write to them later during the lesson. So he thought the best thing to tell his boys about to be is that add up 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 right up to 100. Add that up. And he sat down to write and he took to be done. He said that is 5,000. How did you work it out so quickly? He said, sir, it's very simple. And it is so simple, you can't believe how simple it really is. He said, sir, you said 1, 2, plus 3, plus 4, up to 100. So it means... plus 1 is 16. He said, so that's how it goes. You see, if I add the first one and the last one, it comes to 101. And if I add the second one and the second last one, it comes to 101. And if I do the third one and the third last one, it comes to 98. And if I do the fourth one, 101. And if I do the first one and the fourth and last one, it comes to 101. And if I do the fifth one and the fifth and last one, it comes to 101. So obviously, it's 50,101. That's easy, 50,101 is 5,060. So this schoolmaster said, very good, thank you so much.
and he published an article in the paper. And you see, that story is a blood flow of that in your formula. So the sum equals the number in the series is 100, divided by 2 is 50. The first one in the series plus the last one in the series is 101. Therefore, x equals 5050. As simple as all that. I would be telling the world of this. I had the silver, nobody else. Everybody knew the formula. Easy to do. Everybody had the formula. I had the silver. My whole vision of mathematics changed from that moment. My whole attitude changed from that moment. Mathematics from that moment was a world to me. I had the fear of the guidance that we had. Could pass your examinations with a framework, the greatest of these all, you've got the formula, that's all you've got. You didn't have it, you got. And then you've got the idea that even a Gebar Chochmo or a Mach Shava, whether it is some form of wisdom or a Mach Shava or a thought. Now there is a very great difference in a, knowing the chomer of it, the substance of a thought, the matter of a thought, is a piece of information. Knowing that, and then having the whole, getting the sphere of it, which is the spirit of it, and the feel of it. Now, some of the differences between it. In the actual failure of an idea, the matter of an idea, it doesn't change from one day to another. It's exactly the same each day, but you know, this is the information, that is the formula, it doesn't change. The sphere changes from time to time. It depends on the horizon. As my horizons widen, I get a better understanding of it. As I begin to understand what 365,000 is, as a guy yesterday couldn't understand quite the difference between 47,200, 37,350, and 20,200. You got a little bit confused. I said, which is the greater number? The B'nai of the Uvain counted 47,350 and 37,200 and the B'nai Shimei 20,350 or something like that. So you figure 350 is more than 200. And I said, but 47 is the best of 1,000 because on paper it's better, really understand that he sees it on paper, it's better. It's confused. But as he begins to know, with digits he's arrived at 10, units, 10, 100 he's arrived, 1,000 he's arrived at, 47,000, 8,000, it's a little bit difficult for him. But as he grows and he understands that, it changes. But the information he tells me immediately, the body even has so many, the human has so many, that he knows. That doesn't change. But as one's horizon widens, as one's depth goes deeper, so the understanding of that piece of information I have also becomes deeper. Certainly. So of course, various other differences in it, and that is that the tsuro that I have, the understanding of the form of a thought of an idea, is something that is dependent on my sense of mind and on my mood. There are times when I have a bitter feel for it. And now I'm coming to the word feel. There are times that I have a bitter feel for it. And that depends on my state of mind as it does on my state of spirit, as it does on my mood. There are times that my mood is such and my state of spirit is such that I will have a bigger grasp and a bigger understanding of it, and I will get to the pseudo of it considerably better than I will at other times. Do you hear the information itself? That remains the same all the time. That remains the same all the time. You know when a pianist sits down for his day's work and he's practicing, he usually starts off with scales. And then he starts off with scales. And then he comes to his pieces that he plays. And when I was very small, I used to think that the reason that he does scales is because it is a finger exercise. And the reason that he does his studies is because it is a warming up exercise for his fingers. And then he comes to his pieces. His fingers are first of all are nimble and then they become supple. And now he's ready for them to play. It took me a long time to realize that there's something fascinating about it. When he goes through his scales, and each scale is based on harmony, it prepares him emotionally for his music. When he goes through his studies, it prepares him emotionally for it. And now he is ready to do it. And I only learned that when I was doing the body. That one has to prepare oneself before and set out your piece of God. But that is what he does. He puts himself into a frame of mind that he's now able to start with his pieces. It's not merely something that is technical. There's far beyond being a technicality. There, he wants to get to the tour of it all. And he gets it through his scales first. And then he gets it through his studies. And now he's ready to tackle this piece. So now we are beginning to have some kind of an appreciation of what the tour is. Let me go back to the Gemara with which we start. The case begins on Friday. Can't work out. So don't begin it on Friday. What are you going to say? You can't, because if you finish it on Friday, it's good. But if you don't finish it on Friday, it's got to carry on Sunday. On Sunday, we don't get into in Nashi. The heart of man forgets. Although you've got the two secretaries of yours, though you've got the two stenographers writing down the words of the plaintiff and writing down the words of the defendant, writing down everything that the witnesses say, putting down on paper, word for word, the cross-examination as it occurs, from Sunday to Friday, 48 hours and more. Although everything is written down, says the Gemara, literally inchi-inchi, what is written down are the words that issue from the mouth, but what is in the heart, that isn't written down. The Tzura is not written down. The Chomer is written down, but the Tzura is not written down. What is the case based on? In Torah, the case is based on the Tzura and not on the Chomer. Not just on the evidence, that a judge can take it in chambers and say, just give me and I'll give you it, or an appeal can sit without seeing going into it just on the paper. We can't do anything like that. That is the chomer without the truth. And that is the reason why that commodity is there. And then we are able now to go on a little bit further.
Did you solve the problem with
the language? No, not yet. Not yet. We've seen this. We haven't finished that. That was too much. There's another difference between Chomer and Tzura. And that is, the Chomer is a thing for everyone. You get two people, you give them information, it's the same for everybody. You give two people, you give them the formula, it's the same formula for everyone. You give two people, you give them the information, it's the same information for everybody. Sooner, everyone has got a different understanding and a different appreciation of the truth. No two people have got the same understanding. They've got the same surah sahokma, whereas everyone has got the same chumrah. They say, how they say it, or how they know it, I don't know, but they say that no two people see exactly the same color and the same shade of color. Each one sees it differently. I can't check that, but that is what I have been told. But it goes very much further than that. Two people see a picture, and each one understands it his own way. And both of them can be right. And that is the Surah of. Two people can read a poem, and each one sees something different in it. Each one sees another Surah. The words are exactly the same. Two people can hear a piece of music, and each one has got a different Surah, is moved differently by this piece of music. That is one of the differences between recorded music and live music. Recorded music, no orchestra ever plays a symphony or a concerto the same as it did at any previous time. Must be something different in it. Because that depends on your state of mind, that depends on your mood, that depends on what progress you've made. It depends on your vision of your world, and in the vision of the world, of one's world, if one is progressing dynamically, as one should, and if one is maturing, as one always should, one's horizons are ever being pushed further and further away, and one sees more and more. And as one sees more and more, everything one knows changes as far as the Surah is concerned, provided you are active. If you leave it, then it's gone. The information you've got, but the feel is gone. How long can you leave it without losing the feel? We did it. We did it. How long can you go without losing the feel? After what period of time have you lost the feel if you've left it? After what period of time have you lost the feel of it? Have you done? 48 hours. You've got it. Begin, you've got it. If you begin on Friday and you don't finish it, you can't go and see on Sunday. You've lost 48 hours. The most you can get. That's the most you can get. You might be able to stretch it to 72 hours, but certainly not beyond 72 hours. After 72 hours, the chomer you've got, but the surah you've lost. You want to go into it deeply a bit, you've got to take your chomer, then you've got to go work on it and work on it, and then you can go. But if you are at it all the time, as your horizons go further and further back, and the whole area of your vision lengthens and broadens, the surah of that which you are working becomes deeper and deeper. And that has to be said. Now, and we are mainly concerned with a thought and with an idea. The thought and an idea. Now let us, at this stage, we are already able to understand something of the workings of all this. A person is given an idea. Then, the next step is, this idea engrains itself on the mind. Now he's already beginning to get the pseudo. Once it engrains itself on the mind, it begins, so to say, and I'm using borrowed phrases, I'm using metaphorical language, it spreads itself out all over the heart, and it begins to get a feel of the subject and a feel for the subject, or rather he gets a feel for the subject or for the idea or for the thought and a feel of the thought. And this arouses within him a sense of wonder. He's captivated by it. He's alive to it. He responds to it. His face brightens up. It's discernible in his whole attitude and his whole body. It's discernible. I sometimes give it here, and I put forward a thought, and I put forward an idea, blank, vague, blank papers, empty pages. But do you understand? Yes. The whole of this, the pseudo, when I told you this piece of the morrow, about a case beginning on Friday, it can't get over to Sunday, therefore you can't begin it to Friday. And I said, how long is it before you lose the tour of the talk? And you've got to begin all over again. You weren't able to answer me 48 hours. You didn't get the tour, you got only the information of what I told. You didn't get the tour, you didn't get the tour. And you got the tour, you were able to get that 48 hours. Got the idea? That's how it works. Very easy to get. I want to give you an example. That's the category. You trying to work it out now. Now it's late.
No. My trouble before was there was thinking about it. But, I mean, 48 is not necessarily 48 because let's say that you were able to have the case on Friday. And if the case ended Friday afternoon, it could end and could start Sunday morning, it would be less.
I was thinking 24
because, you know, for a day,
you didn't know that 48 was necessarily
minimum. Actually, I know that 72 is the maximum. After 72 hours, we've got other proofs for the 72 hours. In a case, we are very sensitive to, we are dealing with other people's money, we are dealing with other people's lives. We are very sensitive to this whole thing. Very sensitive to it. We are very, very good. And what do you want to say?
I thought I missed the difference. But
what I don't
understand is that
I'm not
known for 48 hours. It seems to me I'm missing the
I'll give you an example. I'm not going to go through the whole of the Gemara with you, but I'll just give you an example. A woman once came to get out of trouble on a Shabbos morning, Shabbos midday. She was quite distraught, a mother of a child. She said she doesn't know what happened to the child going in. And the child is crying, and she knows the child is bullying, the child is desperate. As soon as she touches the child cries, and the child goes in. She's most disturbed. And she comes to the rabbit. Now, if she was one of these emotional women, which fortunately we haven't got, she would have come and she would have said, please, I've got an iron horror, take off my iron horror with it. Rabbit fell over here with nothing. Here you go, sensible person. He said to her, go home and put on your weakest clothes. And take the child. She goes home to keep on a weekly child, the child goes home. and immediately goes down the town. So a delegation of three is elected by the town to find out from the other side of Holy. And he says, did it relay that? He said, no. He said, you are goats. That is an expression that the rather trouble use when you like people very much. Jesus said, no. If he didn't like it, then he didn't call them anything. And when a certain gentleman in Greece, he was attended by the rather trouble, he had never called him a goat. And one day there was a gathering like this, and the rather trouble was speaking. And the guru said, and one of them asked something, and he said, did this, that, that, and you're a goat. And he goes on you. And then he sees that this person became red, and he got up from his chair, and he went right across the room, kicking with his arms, and said, oh, God, my goat can also laugh. He called him, and he said, you know, you are goats. He said, can't you understand? It's so simple. According to the Torah, if a goat and ox goes three times, then the ox is a goat and got a special law. It's a goat. If it goes once, goes twice, it's a goat. But if the ox goes three times, then he is a goat. So the Gemara makes an exception. How is it he was able to see the answer to the woman's perplexity in the case that's on the Gemara, and the three goats were not able to see it? How is it? Because the Ragachover had the tsuro and they didn't have the tsuro. But I can tell you that if they didn't have a tsuro, they wouldn't have been goats, they would have just been ordinary human beings. So they must have had the tsuro. And the Ragachover's goats, you think he would deal with people who wouldn't have, who only had information, he could never deal with a person like that. They had the Nishmoso, that they didn't have the Nishmoso, the Nishmoso, the Nishmoso. That is, of course they had the Tzuro, but just look to what an extent it went into him, how it engraved itself in his mind, how it spread all over his body, how it captivated him. The sense of amazement that when he was doing the Tosfos, and he never left him. And immediately, this woman comes in with him and says, question, that's the answer to it. Put the two together. They've got to be able to do that. That is Nishmosa de Nishmosa. And that is the power that these people have. I told you once that the Meir Simcha said, the Meir Simcha was one of the great ones of this generation, of this century. The Chavetz Chaim, the Chover, the Meir Simcha, the Chaim Priester, the Chaim Joseph Lipchinsky, they both were the five greatest of this century. The Meir Simcha, you know, when I even mention his name, it just shakes me, the mere mention of his name. He said that until the age of 60, he didn't know what it was to forget. Until the age of 60, he never forgot it. Everything he learned there, just at his fingertips. One day he said he hasn't got a good memory. So they said, but you said that up to the age of 60 you had never forgotten anything. He said, that's true, but not because of my memory. The reason I've never forgotten anything is because whenever I study something, I am filled with a sense of wonderment and amazement. That is the serious power. And overcome by it. That is the serious power. He said, that is what I am. And I don't have to tell you, if you see something that just fills you with wonder, that you never forget. That you never forget. He said, that is what I am. To him it was. The Buddha Padmanabhi, you could tell him the simplest thing. I told you the story once, how we were walking home from Shri Balanga, we were on holiday, and he had made an arrangement with me that I would have breakfast with him, because there's something that he wanted to, I asked him about and wanted to tell me that we would have breakfast again. On the way, a man, I suppose, must have been 30, 35, comes up to him and says, the Jew, he says, I've got nothing to eat. Can I have something for you? I've got nothing to eat. Come with me. I'm going to have breakfast now. Come with me. So we go. We sit down. And Mota sits here. I sit there, and this man sits there. And the landlady brings us food to eat. We're sitting there eating. And it was just the usual light talk to start with, and then this gentleman said to Motto, he said, I can't reciprocate it anyway. He didn't know who Motto was. Motto was a good, he didn't know what it was. He said, I can't reciprocate in any material way. All I can do is say to the bystander. So, Street Stevenson, he said his device tailor was a piece of Rashi. He said, this is the verse in the tailor, and this is the Rashi, and he went through the Rashi. And Motto listened to that Rashi, as if it was the first time in his life that he'd ever heard it. And he was so excited by it, and turned to me, he said, did you hear what this is? And then he went and he dwelt on it and he spoke of it and he said, and he thanked him for it. At the time, I thought it was Mottel's courtesy of the light, which it certainly was. He was the most courteous of the light man as all these things. And even without a trauma, this was a rugged exterior that he put on. This was a pretense. This was a pretense. They never paid without a trauma his salary. They always gave it to his wife. If a widow came eating, he'd take everything he had and he would just give it to her. He couldn't look at it. He was such a kind person, and he was such a good person, but in order to protect himself from he wanted to sit in there and he didn't want to be bothered with anything. Don't forget, he used to go through the whole of Shas once every month, and he went with me to the Tzuras HaChokhmah once every month. He used to go through it. I had a person living in church, he used to go through once every year. But he used to go through once every month. And I told you that he knew it by heart, but if you asked him to say heart, he would ask you to say, come put your back with him, and there was no difference to me. And this was quite an exceptional sort of mind. You know, I want to tell you something else when I speak this thing about these 6 foot months. I don't tell you everything. Because I know there are certain things I tell you I won't believe. But at a shiur that I gave on last Sunday night in Los Angeles, I had to speak about Reb Chaim Ozer. And I said, you know, I don't know what to tell you about Reb Chaim Ozer, but I'll tell you only one thing about Reb Chaim Ozer, and this I know, I heard it from his nephew, who saw this. Reb Chaim Ozer was ambidextrous. He could write with both hands, and he could write equally well with both hands. But he could write two different responses, one with his right hand and one with his left hand, at the same time. And I say to them, if you don't believe me, I don't blame you. But this is true. Fortunately, there was a young man sitting there. He was from Yale. And he said, there was a man at Harvard, and he gave me the man. I think it was Thomas Quincy. He gave Thomas Quincy, he gave me the name of the man. He said, this is a well-known fact, that this man, in those days in Harvard, there were two languages, Latin and Greek. In the older days there was Hebrew also, but you had to be proficient in Latin and Greek. And there was a piece that had to be translated into, first into Latin and into Greek. And he took two separate pads, and one he translated into Latin, one he translated into Greek. So he said that you have. Actually, he could do a third thing also if Chaim is a religious dream. When you got Suez Akhokhma better than you have, then I'll tell you about it. That's what the third thing was. Now I won't tell you about it. So that is the first thing. I'm hesitant to. When anything you tell Moshe Patomansky, if he knew something, he would say it over and over again. He needs another person, he just worked out something, tells him that I'll tell you this. And I used to think that the early days he didn't want to forget it. Motta never forgot. He had such his spines. He had such a sense of wonderment about it all. If a person hasn't got the Tzuvah Sachochma, piece of information, unmoved. I can't tell you how unnerving, how disconcerting, how destructive, how annihilating it is to have a person at the shiur that sits at the shiur with a blank expression, no Tzuvah Sachochma. And you ask him, he repeats it. No Tzuvah Sachochma. That's terrible. We need to get up there and Google the name of the person, because there's actually this is nothing derogatory about it. When we were spending the holiday up in the mountains in Switzerland, there was Rabbi Goldwig, and there was Professor Erlbach, and there was myself. And we were a very good threesome, because our temperaments were very similar, and we had a similar outlook on things. So we, Rabbi Goldwig and I belonged to same school, and Auerbach belonged to quite a different school, but an awfully fine person. His subject was Talmud. So we had heaps to discuss about, and we used to spend a lot of time together. One day, I was sitting with Professor Auerbach, and we were speaking. We'd been speaking for about 5 or 10 minutes, we were waiting for Rabbi Goldberg to come down. Rabbi Goldberg comes down into the lounge of the SM, and he said, "Well, now I've worked out the Rambam after you for years. Oh," he said, "well, come tell us about the Rambam." So he goes to the Rambam, took about 20 minutes. I was filled with such a sense of wonder, the way he worked it out, and then the Rambam becomes clear, and there were difficulties that he pointed out in the Rambam that I've never seen the difficulties, anything goes wrong. So he's saying it, I'm listening to this Auerbach, he says. He finishes it, and then we discuss it a bit. After a while, Rabbi Goldwich turns around to Professor Auerbach, and he says to him, I still remember the words so well. He says, "Es wundert sich. Es wundert mich." There's something I can't understand, and I'm surprised about it. So Professor Auerbach says, "Well, what is it?" He says, "You've got no Hispa'alus. You've got no Hispa'alus. You're not moved. You've no sense of wonder." So Professor Auerbach said, "I understand what you said." He said, "I know you understand. I know you understand. But it doesn't move you at all." Professor Auerbach was Professor of Talmud in Jerusalem. And I say he's an outstanding person. He knows not only the Babylonian Talmud, he knows the Palestinian Talmud, he knows the Jerusalem Talmud. He is interested in what kind of cloak did Rabbi Yehuda Hanosi where that Rabbi Yochanan saw his small finger protruding from it? What kind of a cup was it? And you bring proofs from different Gemaras as to what kind of a cup it was. That is what interests him. He's interested in the historical period. He's interested what beverages did they drink. He's interested what kind of inns did they have. Those are the things that interest him. What they said, the depth of it, the meaning of it, that wasn't his thing. That is the Tzuras Ahava. Now, once we've come to that, I'm going to give you another piece of Gemara. The Gemara says as follows. The literal translation is, the hearts of the early ones. Now the heart is used as a symbol of the receptacle for receiving wisdom. So they said the heart of the early ones was the size of the ulam, that is the hall before coming into the actual temple, which was 20 cubits by 20 cubits. The hearts of the latter ones, that is the generation afterwards, was the size of the hall. That was 10 cubits by 10 cubits. Said they and we, so they're speaking, one generation, the following generation, and ourselves. So it's three successive generations. It means ourselves, the generation before us, and the generation before that. So the generation, our generation, with our generation, it is like the eye of a fine needle. A fine needle. Come down a tremendous amount. Abaya said, and ours, it's like driving a wedge or a peg into a wall. Driving it in, forcing it in. There isn't any opening at all. You just have to force it in and make some kind of an opening. Robert says, and we. Now, you've got now five generations, but they're all in a row. The first generation, he said, we, it's like putting one's finger in on wax, on beeswax, and pressing it in. It then makes a dent in it. It makes an impression in that. Doesn't go through. That is what they say. What are they speaking about? The knowledge. Knowledge can't speak about it. Same for everybody. So what the Gemara is speaking about is the Tzuras Ahava. To what extent it goes, and how it's come down in five generations. That is a piece of Gemara. I've just made some notes of what we can learn from that piece of Gemara. The first thing that we learn is that the greatness of a person is measured not by his knowledge of the facts, by the depth of it, by the feel of it, by the spirit of the wisdom. That is what greatness is measured by, in Torah. The second thing is how exact they were. They said, the first generation, if we're going to translate it into material terms, 20 cubits. The second, 10 cubits. The third, like an eye of a needle. Why do they make it three generations like that? That you shouldn't say, well, then it is 20, and it is 10, and it is 1. Doesn't work like that. Very much less. And then you've got, after that, you've got like a, nothing at all. It's like a pig driving a pig in. And Abaya says, and Robert says, well, with me,
all I can say. So they knew exactly. And the third thing, and this is an interesting thing, there's a reason for it, and I'm not dealing with the reason tonight, but there's a reason for it. I have actually dealt with that reason at another chase of time ago with you. How they take physical things as illustrations of abstract, they take concrete things as illustrations of abstract things, and physical things as illustration of spiritual or intellectual things. But they do it with a purpose. If there's no relationship between the two, they don't do it. It's always done with a purpose, that there's a relationship between the two. The fourth thing we learn is, that a subject we've discussed very much, that the common idea is that man progresses, yes, technologically he progresses, but only technologically. He doesn't progress as far as the sphere is concerned. Having the feel of it, that he doesn't progress. And the fifth thing is, and this is a very surprising thing, what a difference it was in five generations. Now take the fifth generation and the first generation. The fifth generation is wrong, and he says, doesn't penetrate, doesn't go right with it. It's only an impression that it gives. That's our problem. But if he is able to gauge what the early ones were, five generations back, that it was to the extent of 20 cubits, if we're going to make a physical comparison, then he, with all his smallness, comparable smallness, is still able to appreciate the greatness of those. So you can imagine how much greatness there is for him. Otherwise you don't notice it. I came across two things last week. I was reading some Chofetz Chaim. Very fine. And I turned to the introduction, and there are two statements made. One is made by the Chaim Ozer Kuczynski, the man who could write, who was ambidextrous and could write different response, one with his left hand, one with his right hand at the same time, and he could do a third thing that I'm not going to tell you. And you've got Reb Gerber Griske, the son of the great Reb Chaim Griske, who was a definitely great man. These two make statements about the Chofetz Chaim. Reb Chaim Ozer Kuczynski makes a statement about the Chofetz Chaim. He said that in all the, by the way, the Chofetz Chaim who died in 1933, everybody said about him, the great men, well, I think everybody, the great men, all the great men said about him of his age, that he really belonged to two generations now. And don't forget, he lived for, some say he lived for about 95, 98 years, some say he lived for 103 years, 105 years, but it was a long time. Belonged, and you can't take it that from the end he belonged to two generations earlier, because that was still his lifetime. But you've got to take it from when he was already 1860, he belonged to two generations earlier. That means he belonged to the end of the 18th century, that is very, very great stuff there. They said, I'm doing so the Chofetz Chaim. I did three chapters. And then I put it down. I thought, now I want to see this introduction, very good introduction. I want to read the introduction. And the introduction with two quotations from, one from the Chaim Ozer Kuczynski and one from the Belt. The Chaim Ozer Kuczynski said, when the Chofetz Chaim writes, everybody can understand. You can take a child of 12, a child of 15, read, understand. You can take the greatest girl, understand. Each understands it according to his level. That is all. And I put it down with how true this is. That's exactly hitting the nail on the head. I read further. The Belbo says, you can take any part of what the Chofetz Chaim writes. That take a paragraph out of any of his works. You will never be able to say that in this paragraph he surpasses himself. that this paragraph is greater than anything else there, you will never say, you will never find. And I looked at these three chapters, I said, well, even these three chapters, any paragraph, absolutely right. And I became intensely annoyed. How is it I did that? I might have had the Tsula Sahara, I might have had the Nishma Sahara, but they had the Nishma, most of the Nishma Sahara. They could see it. They could see this. Now, the Oral Law. Can you understand why the Oral Law wasn't written down? As soon as you write it down, you kill it. You rob it of its soul and of its spirit. How can you write it down? We wrote it down because we had no way out. We knew it was going to be forgotten if we didn't write it down. So we had to write it down. This brave, there was no way out. But we killed it by writing it down. Can you write down the spirit of the Torah? Can you write down its soul? Can you write down its tzura? Can you write down the feel of it? That was forbidden. That's why the Torah was forbidden. That the Torah should never deteriorate. You can just have the information that's that you can't. Yeah, it's written, you take it up, take the book out, but isn't it? You lay out. But never do that. And to have it from the teacher. I had to have it from Fiji, couldn't have that. I told you, it wasn't only the Bukhara Basra. They didn't, the old Kyoji law. But the Bukhara Basra, this is what I saw. Whenever he gave a shiur, nobody could interrupt him. He wouldn't allow him to interrupt him. And when he finished the shiur, he repeated it. And he repeated it exactly the same, but he gave exactly the same words, the same movements of the hand. Then he picked up his hand, he made a movement of his hand, exactly the same the second time as the first time. When he finished the second time, he said, yes, give him a break, now he comes. And then he was able to take him and he did his questions. When you listen to Eberhorn, and he made a movement of the hand, that movement of the hand, gave you the feel of what it is. For the information, take his books and you've got the information. What a difference it was to hear the commentary. What a difference it was. The difference between life and death. The difference between a soulless body and the soul. What a difference. Now the Yochanan was able to say, what I have is from the finger, the Rebbe's finger, of Yehuda Nosi's finger protruding from his finger. However much he said, the movement of his me. I might have got the tzura, I've got the neshama of it, I've got the neshama de nishmoto, I've got the neshama de nishmoto de nishmoto, I've got the nishmoto de nishmoto de nishmoto, and he gave me another. So that it was a book. With his finger, I saw that it was Venus. With his finger, I saw that it was Venus in a certain state of mind. With his finger, I saw it was Venus in a certain mood. That was not his finger. Just to give that picture. And don't forget, it's the last neshama that changes the whole picture. change is that so sweet. We have come to the end of the Book of Esther. You will know the story. You've got the fullness of it. That is not the truth of the Jews. Some people went away only with the fullness. Also some people started with a chomer, came to the nishmor, the nishom. Some people managed to get the nishmor to the nishmos, not always. Some that is all I expected. I didn't expect it always. Some people say nishmos, some the eight together. We've only got one more shiur to do in Esther and then we've completed. I want to leave that for the seal, and I also want to leave for the seal the beginning of the next study that we will undertake. But the next study we undertake has got to be, the whole purpose has got to be the Surah Ahmad as opposed to the Surah. I've just got one final word to say. I want you to know that Surah Sakhokhma has not only got to do with intelligence, it's got to do with character. Thank you. When are you going to
discuss? May I just make one statement, please? I'm afraid that I tried out your way tonight. Those of you that think you'll be cold, please be in jerseys or scarves or whatever. But the air conditioning will be on for the duration. I really don't think it's fair to sit in this heat. I really don't. And if you really feel cold, either come and sit here or please bring jerseys or whatever you'd like to bring. But I must say that we've got the air conditioning to be given to us for use for our sharing. And I really would like to use it. And I hope that everybody feels okay about it. I think that perhaps we should just vaguely start just deciding what we want to do. Do we want to have the museum in a private home? Do we want to have it in the shul as we had it last year? Just let us hear some of the opinions that we know what to build on when we start making details. And then I would suggest that next week it won't be here.
Well, it's already 3 weeks since we were here.
So we can't do this again?
I don't know. Well, it's not that we can't do it in the 3 weeks, but we want to do it in
the after.
Either straight after Tisha B'Av, I think we've got a Shabbos Nachamu, you know, around that period of Nachamu, would be very much better.
What's happening?
Pardon? What's happening?
Well, I'll take other things with you this week so I can discuss with you.
No, you're not going away.
Pardon?
I thought you said
something about... Well, we're going away just for the next 2 days.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Are we not
going to
this
time?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, we are.
Yes, we are. Yes, yes.
I just want to be accurate.
No, but I think it's all right.
Well, this is a means of secularizing Shavuos. Shavuos is the man my tongue ever said. It is the season of beginning of the Torah Mount Sinai. And we believe that the Torah was given by Hashem himself to Moshe, to the whole people of Israel, who heard the first two commandments. And then after that, they didn't hear the commandments anymore, but they just heard the sound. And then the Torah was given to Moshe, and Moshe taught it to the Am Yisrael. But the first two commandments, they heard Hashem saying the first. Those are our beliefs. This is a secularist attempt to reduce the spirituality of the festival to that of an agricultural festival. With the bringing fruits and it was an agricultural festival. The fruits which had nothing to do with the being agricultural festival at the time of the base of Middash, and the fruits were brought into the temple, and the declaration was made in the base of Middash, and the idea of bringing the fruits was a spiritual idea, but only at the time of the base of Middash too.
And now we declare from the spirituality of the festival, which is the giving of the Torah, by emphasizing an agricultural aspect which isn't without any spirituality. So for that reason I've asked that it shouldn't be flowers and plants and fruit in the shul. And the Bina Gorn was very unhappy about it in his day, and he didn't want it. That is one thing that I wanted to mention to you. Is there anything that I have got to mention to the ladies? You want to speak to them, Susan, I will. Yes, I'll give you that opportunity in a moment. Yes.
You can have that, because I have a question with Lillian McKinnon.
Yes, and then one other thing I just want to mention to the ladies, and that is, well, please don't tell your husband that I spoke to you about this. I don't think it is necessary for me to tell you how important a part, how important is the role that the woman plays in the home and in the life of her husband. Rabbi Yosef used to say, never when I've spoken about my wife have I spoken of her as she. I have not even said my wife, but I have called her Daisy, my hope. Whenever I've addressed myself, it's always been Daisy. And when I write a letter to a colleague, I write at the end of the letter, Rishat Shalom, in Bayit Nevi. Regards from home to home. And he knows what that means. It is from my wife to your wife. And that is the way one writes. The bind the bind. The wife is there. I spoke last Shabbos morning about not only an obligation that one has to a group such as this, but what one does by, for example, staying away from the Shia. One weakens the group. We are such a small group that every person counts. And if there are more people, there's more excitement, and there's more joy, and there's more mood. And if one person stays away, so I spoke about that. I spoke about it in terms of synagogue service. You know, a man comes home from work and he's tired. He's not tired these days. Everybody's tired these days. Everybody's tired. What I know is that when a person comes to a shiur on a Thursday night, tired as he is, and I see them sit in the chair and slump down in the chair, and 5 minutes later, in half an hour's time, there is such enjoyment and life and spirit in half an hour. And then there's some tea. Not because they're not tired, but they are exercising entirely a different area of their mind and of their being. And that is what revitalizes. Coming to a service in the morning, there's Kurdish in there. Coming to a music station, coming to a marriage, coming to a shiva. What the wife can do for the husband in that respect. I once went up to see Rabbi Abramsky when I was in Israel. I knew his life was very good. And I was thinking, should I go up and should I not go up? And I thought, yes, he might just want to have somebody get to be with him a moment. I went up and I knocked at the door, and a woman came up at the door, and I said, he's here. And she said, he's here, but the evidence was very ill. I knew she was dangerously ill. She said, he's very ill. I don't think he wants to see her there. He shouted out. He said, who's there? And she asked me where I was going to tell her. He said, please, let him in. So I went in, and I sat down, and he told me that his wife, he said, this professor had been to her. This morning there was this professor, this afternoon there was this professor, this was evening, there was this professor, he said, I'll do anything I possibly can. He said, I want to tell you why I'm doing it. He said, everything I have is due to that. And he told me how when the Russians sent him to Siberia, and he had to work in Siberia, and the hours was from sunrise to sunset, that he had to be out in the field at sunrise, and he left the field at sunset. How he came home, and that allowed him to take his wife with him. Now when he came to his hut, there was a table with a piece of black bread and some potatoes and something to wash, and he begged his mother, and he ate and he went to bed. And there were 2 o'clock in the morning to work in. And there was the table with his couple of spoons that he brought with him, the pen and the paper and the ink, and there he was able to work and to study and to write. Everything I have, I put down. That is what a wife is for. Please don't give your husbands a husband. But what a wife can do for a husband, nobody else can. Thank you very much. I wish you all a very happy birthday. And I hope I'll see you so soon.
Please forgive us, I'm sorry. Well, the question is, last week you said last week the Mishnah, and you're telling me, make sense if you know why you become a Hashem, if it comes from Hashem. But is there another school of thought that says that the Mishnah is going to be doing, and to find out the reason why.